Sleeping Murder by Agatha Christie, read by Stephanie Cole. Chapter 1. A House. Gwenda Reed stood, shivering a little, on the quayside. The docks and the custom sheds and all of England that she could see were gently waving up and down. And it was in that moment that she made her decision, the decision that was to lead to such very momentous events. She wouldn't go by boat train to London, as she had planned. After all, why should she? No one was waiting for her. Nobody expected her. She had only just got off that heaving, creaking boat. It had been an exceptionally rough 3 days through the bay and up to Plymouth, and the last thing she wanted was to get into a heaving, swaying train. She would go to a hotel, a nice, firm, steady hotel, standing on good, solid ground, and she would get into a nice, steady bed that didn't creak and roll, and she would go to sleep, and the next morning, why, of course, what a splendid idea! She would hire a car, and she would drive slowly and without hurrying herself all through the south of England, looking about for a house, a nice house, the house that she and Giles had planned she should find. Yes, that was a splendid idea. In that way she would see something of England, of the England that Giles had told her about, and which she had never seen, although, like most New Zealanders, she called it home. At the moment, England was not looking particularly attractive. It was a grey day with rain imminent and a sharp, irritating wind blowing. Plymouth, Gwenda thought, as she moved forward obediently in the queue for passports and customs, was probably not the best of England. On the following morning, however, her feelings were entirely different. The sun was shining, the view from her window was attractive, and the universe in general was no longer waving and wobbling. It had steadied down. This was England at last, and here she was, Gwenda Reed, young married woman of 21, on her travels. Giles's return to England was uncertain. He might follow her in a few weeks. It might be as long as 6 months. His suggestion had been that Gwenda should precede him to England and should look about for a suitable house. They both thought it would be nice to have, somewhere, a permanency. Giles's job would always entail a certain amount of travelling. Sometimes Gwenda would come too. Sometimes the conditions would not be suitable. But they both liked the idea of having a home, some place of their own. Giles had inherited some furniture from an aunt recently, so that everything combined to make the idea a sensible and practical one. Since Gwenda and Giles were reasonably well off, the prospect presented no difficulties. Gwenda had demurred at first at choosing a house on her own. "We ought to do it together," she had said. But Giles had said laughingly, "I'm not much of a hand at houses. If you like it, I shall. A bit of a garden, of course, and not some brand-new horror, and not too big. Somewhere on the south coast was my idea. At any rate, not too far inland." "Was there any particular place?" Gwenda asked. But Giles said no. He had been left an orphan young. They were both orphans, and had been passed around to various relations for holidays, and no particular spot had any particular association for him. It was to be Gwenda's house. And as for waiting until they could choose it together, suppose he were held up for 6 months? What would Gwenda do with herself all that time? Hang about in hotels? No, she was to find a house and get settled in. "What you mean is," said Gwenda, "do all the work." But she liked the idea of finding a home, and having it all ready, cosy and lived in, for when Giles came back. They had been married just 3 months, and she loved him very much. After sending for breakfast in bed, Gwenda got up and arranged her plans. She spent a day seeing Plymouth, which she enjoyed, and on the following day she hired a comfortable Daimler car and chauffeur, and set off on her journey through England. The weather was good, and she enjoyed her tour very much. She saw several possible residences in Devonshire, but nothing that she felt was exactly right. There was no hurry. She would go on looking. She learnt to read between the lines of the house agent's enthusiastic descriptions, and saved herself a certain number of fruitless errands. It was on a Tuesday evening, about a week later, that the car came gently down the curving hill road into Dilmouth, and on the outskirts of that still charming seaside resort passed a for-sale board, where, Through the trees, a glimpse of a small white Victorian villa could be seen. Immediately, Gwenda felt a throb of appreciation, almost of recognition. This was her house. Already she was sure of it. She could picture the garden, the long windows. She was sure that the house was just what she wanted. It was late in the day, so she put up at the Royal Clarence Hotel and went to the house agents, whose name she had noted on the board, the following morning. Presently, armed with an order to view, she was standing in the old-fashioned long drawing-room, with its two French windows giving on to a flagged terrace, in front of which a kind of rockery, interspersed with flowering shrubs, fell sharply to a stretch of lawn below. Through the trees at the bottom of the garden, the sea could be seen. "This is my house," thought Gwenda. "It's home. I feel already as though I know every bit of it." The door opened, and a tall, melancholy woman with a cold in the head entered, sniffing. "Mrs. Hengrave, I have an order from Messrs. Galbraith and Penderley. I'm afraid it's rather early in the day." Mrs. Hengrave, blowing her nose, said sadly that it didn't matter at all. The tour of the house began. Yes, it was just right. Not too large, a bit old-fashioned, but she and Giles could put in another bathroom or two. The kitchen could be modernized. It already had an arga, fortunately, with a new sink and up-to-date equipment. Through all Gwenda's plans and preoccupations, the voice of Mrs. Hengrave droned thinly on, recounting the details of the late Major Hengrave's last illness. Half of Gwenda attended to making the requisite noises of condolence, sympathy, and understanding. Mrs. Hengrave's people all lived in Kent, anxious she should come and settle near them. The Major had been very fond of Dilmouth, secretary for many years of the golf club, but she herself... Yes, yes, of course, dreadful for you, most natural. Yes, nursing homes are like that. Of course, you must be... And the other half of Gwenda raced along in thought. Linen cupboard here, I expect, yes. Double room, nice view of the sea. Giles will like that. Quite a useful little room here. Giles might have it as a dressing room. Bathroom. I expect the bath has a mahogany surround. Oh, yes, it has. How lovely. And standing in the middle of the floor. I shan't change that. It's a period piece. Such an enormous bath. One could have apples on the surround, and sailboats and painted ducks. You could pretend you were in the sea. I know. We'll make that dark back spare room into a couple of really up-to-date green and chromium bathrooms. The pipes ought to be all right over the kitchen, and keep this just as it is.
Pleurisy, said Mrs. Hengrave. Turned to double pneumonia on the third day.
Oh, terrible, said Gwenda. Isn't there another bedroom at the end of this passage? There was, and it was just the sort of room she had imagined it would be, almost round with a big bow window. She'd have to do it up, of course. It was in quite good condition, but why were people like Mrs. Hengrave so fond of that mustard-cum-biscuit shade of wall paint? They retraced their steps along the corridor. Gwenda murmured conscientiously, 7 bedrooms carrying the little one and the attic. The boards creaked faintly under her feet. Already she felt that it was she and not Mrs. Hengrave who lived here. Mrs. Hengrave was an interloper, a woman who did up rooms in mustard-cum-biscuit colour and liked a frieze of wisteria in her drawing-room. Gwenda glanced down at the typewritten paper in her hand, on which the details of the property and the price asked were given. In the course of a few days, Gwenda had become fairly conversant with house values. The sum asked was not large. Of course, the house needed a certain amount of modernisation, but even then, and she noted the words, open to offer. Oh, Mrs. Hengrave must be very anxious to go to Kent and live near her people. They were starting down the stairs when, quite suddenly, Gwenda felt a wave of irrational terror sweep over her. It was a sickening sensation, and it passed almost as quickly as it came, yet it left behind a new idea. "The house isn't haunted, is it?" demanded Gwenda. Mrs. Hengrave, a step below, and having just got to the moment in her narrative when Major Hengrave was sinking fast, looked up in an affronted manner.
"Not that I am aware of, Mrs. Reed. Why, has anybody been saying anything of the kind?"
"You've never felt or seen anything yourself. Nobody's died here? Rather an unfortunate question, she thought, a split second of a moment too late, because presumably Major Hengrave...
My husband died in St. Monica's nursing home, said Mrs. Hengrave stiffly.
Oh, of course, you told me so. Mrs. Hengrave continued, in the same rather glacial manner,
In a house which was presumably built about 100 years ago, there would normally be deaths during that period. Miss Elworthy, from whom my dear husband acquired this house 7 years ago, was in excellent health, and indeed planning to go abroad and do missionary work, and she did not mention any recent demises in her family.
Gwenda hastened to soothe the melancholy Mrs. Hengrave down. They were now once more in the drawing-room. It was a peaceful and charming room, with exactly the kind of atmosphere that Gwenda coveted. Her momentary panic just now seemed quite incomprehensible. What had come over her? There was nothing wrong with the house. Asking Mrs. Hengrave if she could take a look at the garden, she went out through the French windows onto the terrace.
"This should be steps here," thought Gwenda, "going down to the lawn."
But instead there was a vast uprising of forsythia, which at this particular place seemed to have got above itself and effectually shut out all view of the sea. Gwenda nodded to herself. She would alter all that. Following Mrs. Hengrave, she went along the terrace and down some steps at the far side onto the lawn. She noted that the rockery was neglected and overgrown, and that most of the flowering shrubs needed pruning. Mrs. Hengrave murmured apologetically that the garden had been rather neglected, only able to afford a man twice a week, and quite often he never turned up. They inspected the small but adequate kitchen garden and returned to the house. Gwenda explained that she had other houses to see, and that though she liked Hillside, what a commonplace name, very much, she could not decide immediately. Mrs. Hengrave parted from her with a somewhat wistful look and a last long lingering sniff. Gwenda returned to the agents, made a firm offer subject to surveyor's report, and spent the rest of the morning walking around Dilmouth. It was a charming and old-fashioned little seaside town. At the far modern end there were a couple of new-looking hotels and some raw-looking bungalows, but the geographical formation of the coast with the hills behind had saved Dilmouth from undue expansion. After lunch, Gwenda received a telephone call from the agents, saying that Mrs. Hengrave accepted her offer. With a mischievous smile on her lips, Gwenda made her way to the post office and dispatched a cable to Giles. "Have bought a house. Love, Gwenda." "That'll tickle him up," said Gwenda to herself. "Show him that the grass doesn't grow under my feet." Chapter 2. Wallpaper. A month had passed, and Gwenda had moved into Hillside. Giles's aunt's furniture had come out of store and was arranged round the house. It was good quality, old-fashioned stuff. One or two over-large wardrobes Gwenda had sold, but the rest fitted in nicely and was in harmony with the house. There were small, gay papier-mâché tables in the drawing-room, inlaid with mother-of-pearl and painted with castles and roses. There was a prim little work-table with a gathered sack underneath of pure silk. There was a rosewood bureau and a mahogany sofa-table. The so-called easy chairs Gwenda had relegated to various bedrooms, and had bought two large, squashy wells of comfort for herself and Giles to stand each side of the fireplace. The large Chesterfield sofa was placed near the windows. For curtains, Gwenda had chosen old-fashioned chintz of pale eggshell blue with prim urns of roses and yellow birds on them. The room, she now considered, was exactly right. She was hardly settled yet, since she had workmen in the house still. They should have been out by now, but Gwenda rightly estimated that until she herself came into residence they would not go. The kitchen alterations were finished, the new bathrooms nearly so. For further decorating, Gwenda was going to wait a while. She wanted time to savour her new home and decide on the exact colour scheme she wanted for the bedrooms. The house was really in very good order, and there was no need to do everything at once. In the kitchen, a Mrs. Cocker was now installed, a lady of condescending graciousness, inclined to repulse Gwenda's over-democratic friendliness, but who, once Gwenda had been satisfactorily put in her place, was willing to unbend. On this particular morning, Mrs. Cocker deposited a breakfast tray on Gwenda's knees as she sat up in bed.
"When there's no gentleman in the house," Mrs. Cocker affirmed, "a lady prefers her breakfast in bed." And Gwenda had bowed to this supposedly English enactment. "Scrambled this morning," Mrs. Cocker observed, referring to the eggs. "You said something about Finn and Haddock, but you wouldn't like it in the bedroom. It leaves a smell. I'm giving it to you for your supper, creamed on toast."
"Oh, thank you, Mrs. Cocker."
Mrs. Cocker smiled graciously and prepared to withdraw. Gwenda was not occupying the big double bedroom. That could wait until Giles returned. She had chosen instead the end room, the one with the rounded walls and the bow window. She felt thoroughly at home in it and happy. Looking round her now, she exclaimed impulsively, "I do like this room." Mrs. Cocker looked round indulgently. "It is quite a nice room, madam, though small. By the bars on the window, I should say it had been the nursery at one time."
"Oh, I never thought of that. Perhaps it has."
"Ah, well," said Mrs. Cocker, with implication in her voice, and withdrew. "Once we have a gentleman in the house," she seemed to be saying, "who knows, a nursery may be needed." Gwenda blushed. She looked round the room. A nursery? Yes, it would be a nice nursery. She began furnishing it in her mind. A big doll's house there against the wall, and low cupboards with toys in them. A fire burning cheerfully in the grate, and a tall guard round it with things airing on the rail. But not this hideous mustard wall. No, she would have a gay wallpaper, something bright and cheerful. Little bunches of poppies alternating with bunches of cornflowers. Yes, that would be lovely. She'd try and find a wallpaper like that. She felt sure she had seen one somewhere. One didn't need much furniture in the room. There were two built-in cupboards, but one of them, a corner one, was locked and the key lost. Indeed, the whole thing had been painted over, so that it could not have been opened for many years. She must get the men to open it up before they left. As it was, she hadn't got room for all her clothes. She felt more at home every day in Hillside. Hearing a throat being ponderously cleared and a short, dry cough through the open window, she hurried over her breakfast. Foster, the temperamental jobbing gardener, who was not always reliable in his promises, must be here today, as he had said he would be. Gwenda bathed, dressed, put on a tweed skirt and a sweater, and hurried out into the garden. Foster was at work outside the drawing-room window. Gwenda's first action had been to get a path made down through the rockery at this point. Foster had been recalcitrant, pointing out that the Forsythia would have to go, and the Wygela, and them their lilacs. But Gwenda had been adamant, and he was now almost enthusiastic about his task. He greeted her with a chuckle. "Looks like you're going back to old times, miss." He persisted in calling Gwenda miss.
"Old times? How?"
Foster tapped with his spade.
"I come on the old step, see? That's where they went, just as you want them now. Then someone planted them over and covered them up."
"It was very stupid of them," said Gwenda.
"You want a vista down to the lawn and the sea from the drawing-room window."
Foster was somewhat hazy about a vista, but he gave a cautious and grudging assent.
"I don't say, mind you, that it won't be an improvement. Gives you a view, and them shrubs made it dark in the drawing-room. Still, they was growing a treat. Never seen a healthier lot of Forsythia. Lilacs ain't much, but them Wygelas costs money, and mind you, they're too old to replant."
"Oh, I know, but this is much, much nicer."
"Well," Foster scratched his head, "maybe 'tis."
"It's right," said Gwenda, nodding her head. She asked suddenly, "Who lived here before the Hengraves? They weren't here very long, were they?"
"Oh, matter 6 years or so. Didn't belong. Afore them, the Miss Elworthys, very churchy folk, low church, missions to the heathen. Once had a black clergyman staying here, they did. Four of them there was, and their brother, but he didn't get much of a look in with all those women. But for them, now, let me see, it was Mrs. Findison. Ah, she was real gentry, she was. She belonged. Was living here afore I was born."
"Did she die here?" asked Gwenda.
"Died out in Egypt or some such place. But they brought her home. She's buried up the churchyard.
She planted that magnolia and those laburnums, and those pittosporas. Fond of shrubs, she was.
Foster continued.
Weren't none of those new houses built up along the hill then. Countrified it was. No cinema then, and none of they new shops, or that there parade on the front.
His tone held the disapproval of the aged for all innovations.
Changes, he said with a snort. Nothing but changes.
Well, I suppose things are bound to change, said Gwenda. And after all, there are lots of improvements nowadays, aren't there?
So they say. I ain't noticed 'em. Changes.
He gestured towards the macrocarpa hedge on the left, through which the gleam of a building showed.
Used to be the cottage hospital, that used, he said. Nice place and handy. Then they goes and builds a great place near to a mile out of town. 20 minutes walk if you want to get there on a visiting day, or threepence on the bus.
He gestured once more towards the hedge.
'Tis a girls' school now. Moved in 10 years ago. Changes all the time. People takes house nowadays, lives in it 10 or 12 years, then off they goes. Restless? What's the good of that? You can't do any proper planting unless you can look well ahead.
Gwenda looked affectionately at the magnolia.
Like Mrs. Findison, she said.
Ah, she was the proper kind. Come here as a bride, she did. Brought up her children and married them, buried her husband, had her grandchildren down in the summers, and took off in the end when she was nigh on 80.
Foster's tone held warm approval. Gwenda went back into the house, smiling a little. She interviewed the workman, and then returned to the drawing-room, where she sat down at the desk and wrote some letters. Amongst the correspondence that remained to be answered was a letter from some cousins of Giles who lived in London. Any time she wanted to come to London, they begged her to come and stay with them at their house in Chelsea. Raymond West was a well-known, rather than popular, novelist, and his wife Joan, Gwenda knew, was a painter. It would be fun to go and stay with them, though probably they would think she was a most terrible Philistine.
Neither Giles nor I are a bit highbrow, reflected Gwenda.
A sonorous gong boomed pontifically from the hall. Surrounded by a great deal of carved and tortured black wood, the gong had been one of Giles's aunt's prized possessions. Mrs. Cocker herself appeared to derive distinct pleasure from sounding it, and always gave full measure. Gwenda put her hands to her ears and got up. She walked quickly across the drawing-room to the wall by the far window, and then brought herself up short with an exclamation of annoyance. It was the third time she'd done that. She always seemed to expect to be able to walk through solid wall into the dining-room next door. She went back across the room and out into the front hall, and then round the angle of the drawing-room wall, and so along to the dining-room. It was a long way round, and it would be annoying in winter, for the front hall was draughty, and the only central heating was in the drawing-room and dining-room and 2 bedrooms upstairs. "I don't see," thought Gwenda to herself as she sat down at the charming Sheraton dining-table, which she had just bought at vast expense in lieu of Aunt Lavender's massive square mahogany one. "I don't see why I shouldn't have a doorway made through from the drawing-room to the dining-room. I'll talk to Mr. Sims about it when he comes this afternoon." Mr. Sims was the builder and decorator, a persuasive, middle-aged man with a husky voice and a little notebook which he always held at the ready to jot down any expensive idea that might occur to his patrons. Mr. Sims, when consulted, was keenly appreciative.
"Simplest thing in the world, Mrs. Reed, and a great improvement, if I may say so."
"Would it be very expensive?" Gwenda was by now a little doubtful of Mr. Sims's assents and enthusiasms. There had been a little unpleasantness over various extras not included in Mr. Sims's original estimate.
"A mere trifle," said Mr. Sims, his husky voice indulgent and reassuring.
Gwenda looked more doubtful than ever. It was Mr. Sims's trifles that she had learnt to distrust. His straightforward estimates were studiously moderate.
"I'll tell you what, Mrs. Reed," said Mr. Sims coaxingly, "I'll get Taylor to have a look when he's finished with the dressing-room this afternoon, and then I can give you an exact idea. Depends what the wall's like."
Gwenda assented. She wrote to Joan West, thanking her for her invitation, but saying that she would not be leaving Dilmouth at present, since she wanted to keep an eye on the workman. Then she went out for a walk along the front, and enjoyed the sea breeze.
She came back into the drawing-room, and Taylor, Mr. Sims's leading workman, straightened up from the corner and greeted her with a grin.
"Won't be no difficulty about this, Mrs. Reed," he said. "Been a door year before their house. Somebody as didn't want it has just had it plastered over."
Gwenda was agreeably surprised. "How extraordinary," she thought, "that I've always seemed to feel there was a door there." She remembered the confident way she had walked to it at lunchtime, and, remembering it, quite suddenly, she felt a tiny shiver of uneasiness. When you came to think of it, it was really rather odd. Why should she have felt so sure that there was a door there? There was no sign of it on the outside wall. How had she guessed, known, that there was a door just there? Of course, it would be convenient to have a door through to the dining room, but why had she always gone so unerringly to that one particular spot? Anywhere on the dividing wall would have done equally well, but she had always gone automatically, thinking of other things, to the one place where a door had actually been. "I hope," thought Gwenda uneasily, "that I'm not clairvoyant or anything." There had never been anything in the least psychic about her. She wasn't that kind of person. Or was she? That path, outside from the terrace, down through the shrubbery to the lawn, had she in some way known it was there, when she was so insistent on having it made in that particular place? "Perhaps I am a bit psychic," thought Gwenda uneasily. "Or is it something to do with the house?" Why had she asked Mrs. Hengrave that day if the house was haunted? It wasn't haunted. It was a darling house. There couldn't be anything wrong with the house. Why, Mrs. Hengrave had seemed quite surprised by the idea. Or had there been a trace of reserve, of wariness in her manner? "Oh, good heavens, I'm beginning to imagine things," thought Gwenda. She brought her mind back with an effort to her discussion with Taylor. "There's one other thing," she added. "One of the cupboards in my bedroom upstairs is stuck. I want to get it opened." The man came up with her and examined the door.
"Oh, it's been painted over more than once," he said. "I'll get the men to get it open for you tomorrow, if that'll do."
Gwenda acquiesced, and Taylor went away. That evening, Gwenda felt jumpy and nervous. Sitting in the drawing-room and trying to read, she was aware of every creak of the furniture. Once or twice she looked over her shoulder and shivered. She told herself repeatedly that there was nothing in the incident of the door and the path. They were just coincidences. In any case, they were the result of plain common sense. Without admitting it to herself, she felt nervous of going up to bed. When she finally got up and turned off the lights and opened the door into the hall, she found herself dreading to go up the stairs. She almost ran up them in her haste, hurried along the passage and opened the door of her room. Once inside, she at once felt her fears calmed and appeased. She looked round the room affectionately. She felt safe in here, safe and happy. Yes, now she was here, she was safe. "Safe from what, you idiot?" she asked herself. She looked at her pyjamas spread out on the bed and her bedroom slippers below them. "Really, Gwenda, you might be 6 years old. You ought to have bunny shoes with rabbits on them." She got into bed with a sense of relief and was soon asleep. The next morning she had various matters to see to in the town. When she came back, it was lunchtime.
"The men have got the cupboard open in your bedroom, madam," said Mrs. Cocker, as she brought in the delicately fried sole, the mashed potatoes, and the creamed carrots.
"Oh, good," said Gwenda. She was hungry and enjoyed her lunch. After having coffee in the drawing-room, she went upstairs to her bedroom. Crossing the room, she pulled open the door of the corner cupboard. Then she uttered a sudden, frightened little cry and stood staring. The inside of the cupboard revealed the original papering of the wall, which elsewhere had been done over in the yellowish wall paint. The room had once been gaily papered in a floral design, a design of little bunches of scarlet poppies alternating with bunches of blue cornflowers. Gwenda stood there, staring a long time. Then she went shakily over to the bed and sat down on it. Here she was, in a house she had never been in before, in a country she had never visited, and only 2 days ago she had lain in bed imagining a paper for this very room, and the paper she had imagined corresponded exactly with the paper that had once hung on the walls.
Wild fragments of explanation whirled round in her head. Done. Experiment with time. Seeing forward instead of back. She could explain the garden path and the connecting door as coincidence. But there couldn't be coincidence about this. You couldn't conceivably imagine a wallpaper of such a distinctive design and then find one exactly as you had imagined it. No. There was some explanation that eluded her, and that, yes, frightened her. Every now and then she was seeing not forward, but back. Back to some former state of the house. Any moment she might see something more, something she didn't want to see. The house frightened her. But was it the house or herself? She didn't want to be one of those people who saw things. She drew a long breath, put on her hat and coat, and slipped quickly out of the house. At the post office, she sent the following telegram. West, 19, Adway Square, Chelsea, London. May I change my mind and come to you tomorrow, Gwenda? She sent it, reply paid. Chapter 3. Cover Her Face. Raymond West and his wife did all they could to make young Giles's wife feel welcome. It was not their fault that Gwenda found them secretly rather alarming. Raymond, with his odd appearance, rather like a pouncing raven, his sweep of hair and his sudden crescendos of quite incomprehensible conversation, left Gwenda round-eyed and nervous. Both he and Joan seemed to talk a language of their own. Gwenda had never been plunged into a highbrow atmosphere before, and practically all its terms were strange. "We've planned to take you to a show or two," said Raymond, while Gwenda was drinking gin and rather wishing she could have had a cup of tea after her journey. Gwenda brightened up immediately. "The ballet tonight at Sadler's Wells, and tomorrow we've got a birthday party on for my quite incredible Aunt Jane, the Duchess of Malfi, with Gielgud. And on Friday you simply must see They Walked Without Feet, translated from the Russian. Absolutely the most significant piece of drama for the last 20 years. It's at the little Whitmore Theatre." Gwenda expressed herself grateful for these plans for her entertainment. After all, when Giles came home, they could go together to the musical shows and all that. She flinched slightly at the prospect of They Walked Without Feet, but supposed she might enjoy it. Only the point about significant plays was that you usually didn't. "You'll adore my Aunt Jane," said Raymond. "She's what I should describe as a perfect period piece, Victorian to the core. All her dressing tables have their legs swathed in chintz. She lives in a village, the kind of village where nothing ever happens, exactly like a stagnant pond." "Something did happen there once," his wife said dryly. "A mere drama of passion, crude, no subtlety to it." "You enjoyed it frightfully at the time," Joan reminded him with a slight twinkle. "I sometimes enjoy playing village cricket," said Raymond with dignity. "Anyway, Aunt Jane distinguished herself over that murder." "Oh, she's no fool. She adores problems." "Problems?" said Gwenda, her mind flying to arithmetic. Raymond waved a hand. "Any kind of problem. Why the grocer's wife took her umbrella to the church social on a fine evening. Why a gill of pickled shrimps was found where it was. What happened to the vicar's surplus. All grist to my Aunt Jane's mill. So, if you've any problem in your life, put it to her, Gwenda. She'll tell you the answer." He laughed, and Gwenda laughed too, but not very heartily. She was introduced to Aunt Jane, otherwise Miss Marple, on the following day. Miss Marple was an attractive old lady, tall and thin, with pink cheeks and blue eyes, and a gentle, rather fussy manner. Her blue eyes often had a little twinkle in them. After an early dinner, at which they drank Aunt Jane's health, they all went off to His Majesty's Theatre. 2 extra men, an elderly artist and a young barrister, were in the party. The elderly artist devoted himself to Gwenda, and the young barrister divided his attentions between Joan and Miss Marple, whose remarks he seemed to enjoy very much. At the theatre, however, this arrangement was reversed. Gwenda sat in the middle of the row between Raymond and the barrister. The lights went down, and the play began. It was superbly acted, and Gwenda enjoyed it very much. She had not seen very many first-rate theatrical productions. The play drew to a close, came to that supreme moment of horror. The actor's voice came over the footlights, filled with the tragedy of a warped and perverted mentality.
Cover her face. Mine eyes dazzle. She died young.
Gwenda screamed. She sprang up from her seat, pushed blindly past the others out into the aisle, through the exit and up the stairs and so to the street. She did not stop even then, but half walked, half ran in a blind panic up the Haymarket. It was not until she reached Piccadilly that she noticed a free taxi cruising along, hailed it, and getting in, gave the address of the Chelsea house. With fumbling fingers she got out money, paid the taxi, and went up the steps. The servant who let her in glanced at her in surprise. "You've come back early, miss. Didn't you feel well?"
"I felt faint."
"Would you like anything, miss? Some brandy?"
No, nothing. I'll go straight up to bed."
She ran up the stairs to avoid further questions. She pulled off her clothes, left them on the floor in a heap, and got into bed. She lay there, shivering, her heart pounding, her eyes staring at the ceiling. She did not hear the sound of fresh arrivals downstairs, but after about 5 minutes the door opened, and Miss Marple came in. She had 2 hot water bottles tucked under her arm and a cup in her hand. Gwenda sat up in bed, trying to stop her shivering.
"Oh, Miss Marple, I'm frightfully sorry. I don't know what... It was awful of me. Are they very annoyed with me?"
"Now, don't worry, my dear child," said Miss Marple. "Just tuck yourself up warmly with these hot water bottles."
"I don't really need a hot water bottle."
"Oh, yes, you do. That's right. And now drink this cup of tea."
It was hot and strong and far too full of sugar, but Gwenda drank it obediently. The shivering was less acute now.
"Just lie down now and go to sleep," said Miss Marple. "You've had a shock, you know. We'll talk about it in the morning. Don't worry about anything. Just go to sleep."
She drew the covers up, smiled, patted Gwenda, and went out. Downstairs, Raymond was saying irritably to Joan, "What on earth was the matter with the girl? Did she feel ill or what?"
"My dear Raymond, I don't know. She just screamed. I suppose the play was a bit too macabre for her."
"Well, of course, Webster is a bit grisly, but I shouldn't have thought..."
He broke off as Miss Marple came into the room.
"Is she all right?"
"Oh, yes, I think so. She's had a bad shock, you know."
"Shock? Just seeing a Jacobean drama?"
"I think there must be a little more to it than that," said Miss Marple thoughtfully.
Gwenda's breakfast was sent up to her. She drank some coffee and nibbled a little piece of toast. When she got up and came downstairs, Joan had gone to her studio. Raymond was shut up in his workroom, and only Miss Marple was sitting by the window, which had a view over the river. She was busily engaged in knitting. She looked up with a placid smile as Gwenda entered.
"Good morning, my dear. You're feeling better, I hope."
"Oh, yes, I'm quite all right. How I could make such an utter idiot of myself last night, I don't know. Are they very mad with me?"
"Oh, no, my dear. They quite understand."
"Understand what?" Miss Marple glanced up over her knitting.
"That you had a bad shock last night," she added gently. "Hadn't you better tell me all about it?"
Gwenda walked restlessly up and down.
I think I'd better go and see a psychiatrist or someone."
"There are excellent mental specialists in London, of course, but are you sure it is necessary?"
"Well, I think I'm going mad. I must be going mad."
An elderly parlourmaid entered the room with a telegram on a salver, which she handed to Gwenda.
"The boy wants to know if there's an answer, ma'am."
Gwenda tore it open. It had been re-telegraphed on from Dilmouth. She stared at it for a moment or two, uncomprehendingly, then screwed it into a ball.
"There's no answer," she said mechanically.
The maid left the room.
"Not bad news, I hope, dear."
"It's Giles, my husband. He's flying home. He'll be here in a week."
Her voice was bewildered and miserable. Miss Marple gave a gentle little cough.
"Well, surely that is very nice, isn't it?"
"Is it? When I'm not sure if I'm mad or not. If I'm mad, I ought never to have married Giles. And the house and everything, I can't go back there. Oh, I don't know what to do."
Miss Marple patted the sofa invitingly.
"Now, suppose you sit down here, dear, and just tell me all about it."
It was with a sense of relief
that Gwenda accepted the invitation. She poured out the whole story, starting with her first view of Hillside, and going on to the incidents that had first puzzled her and then worried her. "And so I got rather frightened," she ended, "and I thought I'd come up to London, get away from it all. Only, you see, I couldn't get away from it. It followed me. Last night..." She shut her eyes and gulped reminiscently. "Last night," prompted Miss Marple. "I dare say you won't believe this," said Gwenda, speaking rather fast. "You'll think I'm hysterical or queer or something. It happened quite suddenly, right at the end. I'd enjoyed the play. I'd never thought once of the house, and then it came out of the blue. When he said those words," she repeated in a low, quivering voice, "cover her face, mine eyes dazzle, she died young. I was back there, on the stairs, looking down on the hall through the banisters, and I saw her lying there, sprawled out, dead, her hair all golden and her face all blue. She was dead, strangled, and someone was saying those words in that same horrible, gloating way, and I saw his hands, grey, wrinkled, not hands, monkey's paws. It was horrible, I tell you, she was dead." Miss Marple asked gently, "Who was dead?" The answer came back quick and mechanical. "Helen." Chapter 4. Helen. For a moment, Gwenda stared at Miss Marple. Then she pushed back the hair from her forehead. "Why did I say that?" she said. "Why did I say Helen? I don't know any Helen." She dropped her hands with a gesture of despair. "You see," she said, "I'm mad. I imagine things. I go about seeing things that aren't there. First it was only wallpapers, but now it's dead bodies. So I'm getting worse." "Now don't rush to conclusions, my dear. Or else it's the house. The house is haunted or bewitched or something. I see things that have happened there, or else I see things that are going to happen there, and that would be worse. Perhaps a woman called Helen is going to be murdered there. Only I don't see if it's the house that's haunted, why I should see these awful things when I'm away from it. So I think really that it must be me that's going queer, and I'd better go and see a psychiatrist at once, this morning." "Well, of course, Gwenda dear, you can always do that when you've exhausted every other line of approach. But I always think myself that it's better to examine the simplest and most commonplace explanations first. Let me get the facts quite clear. There were three definite incidents that upset you. A path in the garden that had been planted over, but that you felt was there. A door that had been bricked up. And a wallpaper which you imagined correctly and in detail without having seen it. Am I right?"
"Yes."
"Well, the easiest, the most natural explanation would be that you had seen them before."
"In another life, you mean?"
"Well, no, dear. I mean in this life. I mean that they might be actual memories."
"But I've never been in England until a month ago, Miss Marple."
"You're quite sure of that, my dear?"
"Of course I'm sure. I've lived near Christchurch in New Zealand all my life."
"Were you born there?"
No, I was born in India. My father was a British Army officer. My mother died a year or two after I was born, and he sent me back to her people in New Zealand to bring up. Then he himself died a few years later."
"You don't remember coming from India to New Zealand?"
"Not really. I do remember, frightfully vaguely, being on a boat, a round window thing, a porthole, I suppose, and a man in white uniform, with a red face and blue eyes, and a mark on his chin, a scar, I suppose. He used to toss me up in the air, and I remember being half frightened and half loving it. But it's all very fragmentary."
"Do you remember a nurse, or an ayah?"
"Or not an ayah, Nanny. I remember Nanny, because she stayed for some time, until I was 5 years old. She cut ducks out of paper. Yes, she was on the boat. She scolded me when I cried, because the captain kissed me, and I didn't like his beard."
"Now, that's very interesting, dear. Because, you see, you are mixing up two different voyages.
In one, the captain had a beard, and in the other, he had a red face and a scar on his chin.
Yes, Gwenda considered. I suppose I must be.
It seems possible to me, said Miss Marple, that when your mother died, your father brought you to England with him first, and that you actually lived at this house, Hillside. You've told me, you know, that the house felt like home to you as soon as you got inside it. And that room you chose to sleep in, it was probably your nursery. It was a nursery. There were bars on the windows. You see, it had this pretty gay paper of cornflowers and poppies. Children remember their nursery walls very well. I've always remembered the mauve irises on my nursery walls, and yet I believe it was repapered when I was only three. And that's why I thought at once of the toys, the doll's house and the toy cupboards. Yes. And the bathroom, the bath with the mahogany surround. You told me that you thought of sailing ducks in it as soon as you saw it.
Gwenda said thoughtfully, It's true that I seem to know right away just where everything was, the kitchen and the linen cupboard, and that I kept thinking there was a door through from the drawing room to the dining room. But surely it's quite impossible that I should come to England and actually buy the identical house I'd lived in long ago.
It's not impossible, my dear. It's just a very remarkable coincidence. And remarkable coincidences do happen. Your husband wanted a house on the south coast. You were looking for one, and you passed a house that stirred memories and attracted you. It was the right size and a reasonable price, and so you bought it. No, it's not too wildly improbable. Had the house been merely what is called, perhaps rightly, a haunted house, you would have reacted differently, I think. But you had no feeling of violence or repulsion, except, so you have told me, at one very definite moment, and that was when you were just starting to come down the staircase and looking down into the hall.
Some of the scared expression came back into Gwenda's eyes. She said, You mean that Helen, that's true too?
Miss Marple said very gently, Well, I think so, my dear. I think we must face the position that if the other things are memories, that is a memory too.
That I really saw someone killed, strangled, and lying there dead?
I don't suppose you knew consciously that she was strangled. That was suggested by the play last night, and fits in with your adult recognition of what a blue, convulsed face must mean. I think a very young child, creeping down the stairs, would realize violence and death and evil, and associate them with a certain series of words. For I think there's no doubt that the murderer actually said those words. It would be a very severe shock to a child. Children are odd little creatures. If they are badly frightened, especially by something they don't understand, they don't talk about it. They bottle it up. Seemingly, perhaps, they forget it. But the memory is still there, deep down.
Gwenda drew a deep breath.
And you think that's what happened to me? But why don't I remember it all now?
One can't remember to order, and often when one tries to, the memory goes further away. But I think there are one or two indications that that is what did happen. For instance, when you told me just now about your experience in the theatre last night, you used a very revealing turn of words. You said you seemed to be looking through the banisters. But normally, you know, one doesn't look down into a hall through the banisters, but over them. Only a child would look through.
That's clever of you, said Gwenda appreciatively. These little things are very significant.
But who was Helen?
Asked Gwenda in a bewildered way.
Tell me, my dear, are you still quite sure it was Helen?
Yeah. It's frightfully odd, because I don't know who Helen is, but at the same time I do know. I know that it was Helen lying there. How am I going to find out more?
Well, I think the obvious thing to do is to find out definitely if you ever were in England as a child, or if you could have been. Your relatives, Gwenda interrupted.
Aunt Alison, she would know, I'm sure.
Then I should write to her by airmail. Tell her circumstances have arisen which make it imperative for you to know if you have ever been in England. You would probably get an answer by airmail by the time your husband arrives.
Oh, thank you, Miss Marple.
You've been frightfully kind, and I do hope what you've suggested is true, because if so, well, it's quite all right. I mean, it won't be anything supernatural.
Miss Marple smiled. I hope it turns out as we think. I am going to stay with some old friends of mine in the north of England the day after tomorrow. I shall be passing back through London in about 10 days. If you and your husband are here then, or if you have received an answer to your letter, I should be very curious to know the result.
Of course, dear Miss Marple. Anyway, I want you to meet Giles. He's a perfect pet, and we'll have a good powwow about the whole thing.
Gwenda's spirits were fully restored by now. Miss Marple, however, looked thoughtful. Chapter 5. Murder in Retrospect. It was some 10 days later that Miss Marple entered a small hotel in Mayfair and was given an enthusiastic reception by young Mr. and Mrs. Reed.
"This is my husband, Miss Marple. Giles, I can't tell you how kind Miss Marple was to me."
"I'm delighted to meet you, Miss Marple. I hear Gwenda nearly panicked herself into a lunatic asylum."
Miss Marple's gentle blue eyes summed up Giles Reed favourably. A very likeable young man, tall and fair, with a disarming way of blinking every now and then out of a natural shyness. She noted his determined chin and the set of his jaw.
"We'll have tea in the little waiting room, the dark one," said Gwenda. "Nobody ever comes there. And then we can show Miss Marple Aunt Alison's letter."
"Yes," she added, as Miss Marple looked up sharply, "it's come, and it's almost exactly what she thought."
Tea over, the airmail letter was spread out and read. "Dearest Gwenda," Miss Danby had written, "I was much disturbed to hear you had had some worrying experience. To tell you the truth, it had really entirely escaped my memory that you had actually resided for a short time in England as a young child. Your mother, my sister Megan, met your father, Major Halliday, when she was on a visit to some friends of ours at the time stationed in India. They were married, and you were born there. About 2 years after your birth, your mother died. It was a great shock to us, and we wrote to your father, with whom we had corresponded, but whom actually we had never seen, begging him to entrust you to our care, as we would be only too glad to have you, and it might be difficult for an army man stranded with a young child. Your father, however, refused, and told us he was resigning from the army and taking you back with him to England. He said he hoped we would at some time come over and visit him there. I understand that on the voyage home your father met a young woman, became engaged to her, and married her as soon as he got to England. The marriage was not, I gather, a happy one, and I understand they parted about a year later. It was then that your father wrote to us and asked if we were still willing to give you a home. I need hardly tell you, my dear, how happy we were to do so. You were sent out to us in the charge of an English nurse, and at the same time your father settled the bulk of his estate upon you and suggested that you might legally adopt our name. This, I may say, seemed a little curious to us, but we felt that it was kindly meant and intended to make you more one of the family. We did not, however, adopt that suggestion. About a year later, your father died in a nursing home. I surmise that he had already received bad news about his health at the time when he sent you out to us. I'm afraid I cannot tell you where you lived whilst with your father in England. His letter naturally had the address on it at the time, but that is now 18 years ago, and I'm afraid one doesn't remember such details. It was in the south of England, I know, and I fancy Dilmouth is correct. I had a vague idea it was Dartmouth, but the two names are not unlike. I believe your stepmother married again, but I have no recollection of her name, nor even of her unmarried name, though your father had mentioned it in the original letter telling of his remarriage. We were, I think, a little resentful of his marrying again so soon, but of course one knows that on board ship the influence of propinquity is very great, and he may also have thought that it would be a good thing on your account. It seemed stupid of me not to have mentioned to you that you had been in England, even if you didn't remember the fact. But, as I say, the whole thing had faded from my mind. Your mother's death in India, and your subsequently coming to live with us, always seemed the important points. I hope this is all cleared up now. I do trust Giles will soon be able to join you. It is hard for you both being parted at this early stage. All my news in my next letter,
as I am sending this off hurriedly in answer to your wire. Your loving aunt, Alison Danby. P.S. You do not say what your worrying experience was.
You see, said Gwenda, it's almost exactly as you suggested.
Miss Marple smoothed out the flimsy sheet.
Yes, yes indeed. The common sense explanation. I found, you know, that that is so often right.
Well, I'm very grateful to you, Miss Marple, said Giles. Poor Gwenda was thoroughly upset, and I must say, I'd have been rather worried myself to think that Gwenda was clairvoyant or psychic or something.
It might be a disturbing quality in a wife, said Gwenda, unless you've always led a thoroughly blameless life.
Which I have, said Giles.
And the house? What do you feel about the house? Asked Miss Marple.
Oh, that's all right. We're going down tomorrow. Giles is dying to see it.
I don't know whether you realize it, Miss Marple, said Giles, but what it amounts to is that we've got a first-class murder mystery on our hands. Actually, on our very doorstep, or, more accurately, in our front hall.
I had thought of that, yes, said Miss Marple slowly. And Giles simply loves detective stories, said Gwenda.
Well, I mean, it is a detective story. Body in the hall of a beautiful strangled woman, nothing known of her but her Christian name. Of course, I know it's nearly 20 years ago. There can't be any clues after all this time, but one can at least cast about and try to pick up some of the threads. Oh, I dare say one won't succeed in solving the riddle.
I think you might, said Miss Marple, even after 18 years. Yes, I think you might.
But at any rate, it won't do any harm to have a really good try.
Giles paused, his face beaming.
Miss Marple moved uneasily. Her face was grave, almost troubled. But it might do a great deal of harm, she said. I would advise you both, oh yes, I really would advise it very strongly, to leave the whole thing alone.
Leave it alone? Our very own murder mystery, if it was murder.
It was murder, I think, and that's why I should leave it alone. Murder isn't, it really isn't, a thing to tamper with light-heartedly.
Giles said, But Miss Marple, if everybody felt like that,
she interrupted him. Oh, I know. There are times when it is one's duty, an innocent person accused, suspicion resting on various other people, a dangerous criminal at large who may strike again. But you must realize that this murder is very much in the past. Presumably it wasn't known for murder. If so, you would have heard fast enough from your old gardener or someone down there. A murder, however long ago, is always news. No, the body must have been disposed of somehow, and the whole thing never suspected. Are you sure, are you really sure, that you are wise to dig it all up again?
Miss Marple, cried Gwenda, you sound really concerned.
I am, my dear. You are two very nice and charming young people, if you will allow me to say so. You are newly married and happy together. Don't, I beg of you, start to uncover things that may, well, that may, how shall I put it, that may upset and distress you.
Gwenda stared at her. You're thinking of something special, of something, what is it you're hinting at?
Not hinting, my dear. Just advising you, because I've lived a long time and know how very upsetting human nature can be, to let well alone. That's my advice. Let well alone.
But it isn't letting well alone.
Giles' voice held a different note, a sterner note. Hillside is our house, Gwenda's and mine, and someone was murdered in that house, or so we believe. I'm not going to stand for murder in my house and do nothing about it, even if it is 18 years ago.
Miss Marple sighed. I'm sorry, she said. I imagine that most young men of spirit would feel like that. I even sympathize and almost admire you for it. But I wish, oh, I do wish that you wouldn't do it.
On the following day, news went round the village of St. Mary Mead that Miss Marple was at home again. She was seen in the High Street at 11 o'clock. She called at the vicarage at 12:10. That afternoon, three of the gossipy ladies of the village called upon her and obtained her impressions of the gay metropolis, and this tribute to politeness over, themselves plunged into details of an approaching battle over the fancy-work stall at the fete and the position of the tea-tent. Later that evening, Miss Marple could be seen as usual in her garden. But for once, her activities were more concentrated on the depredations of weeds than on the activities of her neighbours. She was distray at her frugal evening meal, and hardly appeared to listen to her little maid Evelyn's spirited account of the goings-on of the local chemist. The next day she was still distray, and one or two people, including the vicar's wife, remarked upon it. That evening Miss Marple said that she did not feel very well and took to her bed. The following morning she sent for Dr. Haydock. Dr. Haydock had been Miss Marple's physician, friend, and ally for many years. He listened to her account of her symptoms, gave her an examination, then sat back in his chair and waggled his stethoscope at her. "For a woman of your age," he said, "and in spite of that misleading, frail appearance, you're in remarkably good fettle." "I'm sure my general health is sound," said Miss Marple, "but I confess I do feel a little overtired, a little run down."
"You've been gallivanting about, late nights in London."
"That, of course. I do find London a little tiring nowadays. And the air so used up, not like fresh seaside air."
"The air of St. Mary Mead is nice and fresh,
but often damp and rather muggy. Not, you know, exactly bracing." Dr. Haydock eyed her with a dawning of interest.
"I'll send you round a tonic," he said obligingly.
"Thank you, Doctor. Eastern syrup is always very helpful."
"There's no need for you to do my prescribing for me, woman."
"I wondered if perhaps a change of air?" Miss Marple looked questioningly at him with guileless blue eyes.
"You've just been away for 3 weeks."
"I know, but to London, which, as you say, is enervating, and then up north, a manufacturing district, not like bracing sea air."
Dr. Haydock packed up his bag, then he turned round, grinning. "Let's hear why you sent for me," he said. "Just tell me what it's to be, and I'll repeat it after you. You want my professional opinion that what you need is sea air."
"I knew you'd understand," said Miss Marple gratefully.
"Excellent thing, sea air. You'd better go to Eastbourne right away, or your health may suffer seriously."
"Eastbourne, I think, is rather cold. The Downs, you know."
"Bournemouth, then, or the Isle of Wight?"
Miss Marple twinkled at him. "I always think a small place is much pleasanter."
Dr. Haydock sat down again. "My curiosity is roused. What small seaside town are you suggesting?"
"Well, I had thought of Dilmouth."
"Pretty little place, rather dull. Why Dilmouth?"
For a moment or two Miss Marple was silent.
The worried look had returned to her eyes. She said,
"Supposing that one day, by accident, you turned up a fact that seemed to indicate that many years ago, 19 or 20, a murder had occurred. That fact was known to you alone. Nothing of the kind had ever been suspected or reported. What would you do about it?"
"Murder in retrospect, in fact?"
"Just exactly that."
Haydock reflected for a moment. "There had been no miscarriage of justice. Nobody had suffered as a result of this crime."
"As far as one can see, no."
Murder in retrospect. Sleeping murder. Well, I'll tell you. I'd let sleeping murder lie. That's what I'd do. Messing about with murder is dangerous. It could be very dangerous."
"That's what I'm afraid of."
"People say a murderer always repeats his crimes. Well, that's not true. There's a type who commits a crime, manages to get away with it, and is darn careful never to stick his neck out again. I won't say they live happily ever after. I don't believe that's true. There are many kinds of retribution. But outwardly, at least, all goes well. Perhaps that was so in the case of Madeline Smith, or again in the case of Lizzie Borden. It was not proven in the case of Madeline Smith, and Lizzie was acquitted. But many people believe both of those women were guilty. I could name you others. They never repeated their crimes. One crime gave them what they wanted, and they were content. But suppose some danger had menaced them. I take it your killer, whoever he or she is, was one of that kind. He committed a crime and got away with it, and nobody suspected. But supposing somebody goes poking about, digging into things, turning up stones and exploring avenues, and finally, perhaps, hitting the target. What's your killer going to do about it? Just stay there smiling while the hunt comes nearer and nearer? No, if there's no principle involved, I'd say, let it alone."
He repeated his former phrase.
Let sleeping murder lie," he added firmly, "and those are my orders to you. Let the whole thing alone."
"But it's not I who am involved. It's two very delightful children, let me tell you."
She told him the story, and Haydock listened. "Extraordinary," he said when she had finished. "Extraordinary coincidence. Extraordinary business altogether. I suppose you see what the implications are."
"Oh, of course. But I don't think it's occurred to them yet."
"It will mean a good deal of unhappiness, and they'll wish they'd never meddled with the thing. Skeletons should be kept in their cupboards. Still, you know, I can quite see young Giles's point of view. Dash it all, I couldn't leave the thing alone myself. Even now I'm curious." He broke off and directed a stern glance at Miss Marple. "So that's what you're doing with your excuses to get to Dilmouth, mixing yourself up in something that's no concern of yours."
"Not at all, Dr. Haydock. But I'm worried about those two. They're very young and inexperienced, and much too trusting and credulous. I feel I ought to be there to look after them."
"So that's why you're going, to look after them. Can't you ever leave murder alone, woman? Even murder in retrospect?" Miss Marple gave a small, prim smile.
"But you do think, don't you, that a few weeks at Dilmouth would be beneficial to my health?"
"More likely be the end of you," said Dr. Haydock. "But she won't listen to me."
On her way to call upon her friends, Colonel and Mrs. Bantry, Miss Marple met Colonel Bantry coming along the drive, his gun in his hand and his spaniel at his heels. He welcomed her cordially.
"Glad to see you back again. How's London?"
Miss Marple said that London was very well. Her nephew had taken her to several plays.
"Highbrow ones, I bet. Only care for a musical comedy myself."
Miss Marple said that she had been to a Russian play that was very interesting, though perhaps a little too long.
"Russians," said Colonel Bantry explosively.
He had once been given a novel by Dostoevsky to read in a nursing home. He added that Miss Marple would find Dolly in the garden. Mrs. Bantry was almost always to be found in the garden. Gardening was her passion. Her favourite literature was bulb catalogues, and her conversation dealt with primulas, bulbs, flowering shrubs, and alpine novelties. Miss Marple's first view of her was a substantial posterior clad in faded tweed. At the sound of approaching steps, Mrs. Bantry reassumed an erect position with a few creaks and winces. Her hobby had made her rheumaticky, wiped her hot brow with an earth-stained hand, and welcomed her friend.
"Heard you were back, Jane," she said. "Aren't my new delphiniums doing well? Have you seen these new little gentians? I've had a bit of trouble with them, but I think they're all set now. What we need is rain. It's been terribly dry," she added. "Esther told me you were ill, in bed."
Esther was Mrs. Bantry's cook and liaison officer with the village.
"I'm glad to see it's not true."
"Just a little overtired," said Miss Marple. "Dr. Haydock thinks I need some sea air. I'm rather run down."
"Oh! But you couldn't go away now," said Mrs. Bantry. "This is absolutely the best time of the year in the garden. Your border must be just coming into flower."
"Dr. Haydock thinks it would be advisable."
"Well, Haydock's not such a fool as some doctors," admitted Mrs. Bantry grudgingly.
"I was wondering, Dolly, about that cook of yours."
"Which cook? Do you want a cook? You don't mean that woman who drank, do you?"
"No, no, 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 no. I mean the one who made such delicious pastry, with a husband who was the butler."
"You mean the Mock Turtle," said Mrs. Bantry with immediate recognition. "Woman with a deep, mournful voice, always sounded as though she was going to burst into tears. She was a good cook. Husband was a fat, rather lazy man. Arthur always said he watered the whiskey. I don't know. Pity there's always one of the couple that's unsatisfactory. They got left a legacy by some former employer, and they went off and opened a boarding house on the south coast."
"That's just what I thought. Wasn't it at Dilmouth?"
"That's right. 14, Sea Parade, Dilmouth."
"I was thinking that as Dr. Haydock had suggested the seaside, I might go to... was their name Saunders?"
"Yes! That's an excellent idea, Jane. You couldn't do better. Mrs. Saunders will look after you well... and as it's out of season, they'll be glad to get you and won't charge very much. With good cooking and sea air, you'll soon pick up."
"Thank you, Dolly," said Miss Marple. "I expect I shall."
Chapter 6 Exercise in Detection.
"'Where do you think the body was?'
"'About here?' asked Giles. He and Gwenda were standing in the front hall of Hillside. They had arrived back the night before, and Giles was now in full cry. He was as pleased as a small boy with his new toy.
"'Just about,' said Gwenda.
She retreated up the stairs and peered down critically.
"'Yes, I think that's about it.'
"'Crouch down,' said Giles. "'You're only about 3 years old, you know.' Gwenda crouched obligingly.
"'You couldn't actually see the man who said the words?'
"'I can't remember seeing him. "'He must have been just a bit further back. "'Yes, yes, there. "'I could only see his paws.'
"'Paws?'
Giles frowned. "'They were paws, grey paws, not human.'
"'But look here, Gwenda, this isn't a kind of murder-in-the-room morgue. "'A man doesn't have paws.'
"'Well, he had paws.'
Giles looked doubtfully at her. "'You must have imagined that bit afterwards.'
Gwenda said slowly, "'Don't you think I may have imagined the whole thing? "'You know, Giles, I've been thinking. "'It seems to me far more probable that the whole thing was a dream. "'It might have been. "'It was the sort of dream a child might have "'and be terribly frightened and go on remembering about. "'Don't you think really that's the proper explanation? "'Because nobody in Dilmouth seems to have the faintest idea "'that there was ever a murder or a sudden death "'or a disappearance or anything odd about this house.'
"'Giles looked like a different kind of little boy, "'a little boy who has had his nice new toy taken away from him.
"'Oh, I suppose it might have been a nightmare,' he admitted grudgingly.
"'Then his face cleared suddenly. "'No,' he said, "'I don't believe it.' "'You could have dreamt about monkey's paws and someone dead, "'but I'm damned if you could have dreamt that quotation from the Duchess of Malfi.'
"'I could have heard someone say it and then dreamt about it afterwards.'
"'I don't think any child could do that. "'Not unless you heard it in conditions of great stress. "'And if that was the case, we're back again where we were. "'Hold on, I've got it. "'It was the paws you dreamt.' "'You saw the body, and heard the words, and you were scared stiff, "'and then you had a nightmare about it, "'and there were waving monkeys' paws, too. "'Probably you were frightened of monkeys.'
"'Gwenda looked slightly dubious. "'She said slowly, "'I suppose that might be it. "'I wish you could remember a bit more.
"'Come down here in the hall. "'Shut your eyes. Think. "'Now, doesn't anything more come back to you?'
"'No, it doesn't, Giles. "'The more I think, the further it all goes away.' I mean, I'm beginning to doubt now if I ever really saw anything at all. Perhaps the other night I just had a brainstorm in the theatre.
No, there was something. Miss Marple thinks so too.
What about Helen?
Surely you must remember something about Helen.
I don't remember anything at all. It's just a name.
It mightn't even be the right name.
Oh, yes, it was. It was Helen.
Gwenda looked obstinate and convinced. Then... "'If you're so sure it was Helen, you must know something about her,' said Giles reasonably. "'Did you know her well? Was she living here or just staying here?'
"'I tell you, I don't know.'
Gwenda was beginning to look strained and nervy. Giles tried another tack. "'Who else can you remember? Your father?'
"'No. I mean, I can't tell. There was always his photograph, you see. "'And Alison used to say, "'That's your daddy.' I don't remember him here, in this house.
And no servants, nurses, anything like that?
No. No, the more I try to remember, the more it's all a blank. The things I know are all underneath, like walking to that door automatically. I didn't remember a door there. Perhaps if you wouldn't worry me so much, Giles, things would come back more. Anyway, trying to find out about it all is hopeless. It's so long ago.
Of course it's not hopeless. Even old Miss Marple admitted that.
She didn't help us with any ideas of how to set about it, said Gwenda. And yet I feel, from the glint in her eye, that she had a few. I wonder how she would have gone about it.
I don't suppose she would be likely to think of ways that we wouldn't, said Giles positively. We must stop speculating, Gwenda, and set about things in a systematic way. We've made a beginning. I've looked through the parish registers of deaths. There's no Helen of the right age amongst them. In fact, there doesn't seem to be a Helen at all in the period I covered. Ellen Pug, 94, was the nearest. Now, we must think of the next profitable approach.
If your father, and presumably your stepmother, lived in this house, they must either have bought it or rented it. Well, according to Foster, the gardener, some people called Elworthy had it before the Hengraves, and before them, Mrs. Findison. Nobody else.
Your father might have bought it and lived in it for a very short time, and then sold it again.
But I think that it's much more likely that he rented it. Probably rented it furnished. If so, our best bet is to go round the house agents.
End of Disc 1.